Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Scientists, mathematicians, philosophers, and poets all continue the search for meaning in the universe. Dr. Patarasati Nag is professor of mathematics at Black Hill State University. He recently presented a Geek Speak lecture at Black Hill State on the quest for the theory of everything. So we caught up with Dr. Nag to discuss the fundamentals of nature and the mysteries yet to be discovered in the universe. Has to do with all this from a historical perspective before we jump into things as they stand today?
Sure. It started in 1905 with Einstein's special theory of relativity, which described, motion of objects which are not in a gravitational field. In other words, there is no gravity in Einstein's special theory of relativity. Then, by 1915, Einstein was working from that time onwards to generalize the theory of special relativity. And at the end, around 1915, he, along with another mathematician who was developing the theory at the same time in Göttingen, name is David Hilbert, they developed this theory of gravity, which is essentially that space-time, which is the essential object in Einstein's special theory of relativity, that the curvature of the space-time, that means how much the space is curved, that is actually the essence of gravity. So now big objects obviously curve space more compared to smaller objects like a baseball versus a planet like Jupiter or an object like Sun, which is even bigger. So now, by this time, during this course of research that was going on special and general relativity, there was a parallel research was going on in which also Einstein was involved, and in which, in fact, he won the Nobel Prize in, which is the photoelectric effect, where Albert Einstein and others, like the key figures I'm talking about here, there are other people involved, of course. And there are Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger was developing the theory of the small, which is essentially like electron or even smaller objects. So subatomic particles, let's put it that way.
Sure.
So now what happened was that there was very interesting things that were being observed when they were developing this theory of ultra-small, which is called the quantum theory. Hmm. Now, essentially, the quantum theory has very, very interesting features, and one of the features is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which kind of captures the strangeness of quantum phenomena, is that when you measure a particle's, a subatomic particle's position, its momentum, or its velocity rather, I should say, the error in the measurement becomes infinite. So that means you cannot simultaneously measure the position and the velocity at the same time, which sounds absolutely ridiculous in general sense, because you can measure a car approaching and you can see its position, measure its position as well as its velocity. I mean, we do it almost every day. In fact, in baseball, it is done. But in subatomic level, that is a very strange, this is the uncertainty that is observed. Now, this theory of quantum mechanics, when it first developed, it didn't have anything to do with special theory of relativity. And then, gradually, the special theory of relativity was included into the quantum theory. And when it was included, this was over a period of time and with many, many researchers involved. We developed what is known as nowadays called quantum field theory.
Quantum field theory?
Yeah.
Okay. Was Einstein, that was something that he was down with?
No, Einstein was, at that point, he was involved, but which he used to call the unified field theory. But what happened was that research that he was following through met with some difficulty, it took quite a bit of time, and there were other researchers. One of the primary ones, people have heard about him, and he's quite famous in popular literature, Richard Feynman.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Richard Feynman of Caltech was one of the great researchers who successfully integrated quantum theory, field theory of electrodynamics, which is known as QED, he used to call it, the quantum electrodynamics. That was the first quantum field theory in which the successful unification of special relativity and electromagnetic forces were combined. Then there were several other developments, which included people like Steven Weinberg and so on, Sheldon Glashow, a lot of other scientists. I would also name a few others, Schwinger. There is a whole group of scientists now, physicists, who were Yang Mills, who were involved in development of the quantum field theory.
Is there a way to explain what everybody's looking for? I mean, is there some sort of holy grail here that if we can figure this out, this is what we're trying to figure out? Or are these just different little elements that don't necessarily fit together?
Sure, yeah. So what happened was, so notice that the special theory of relativity got integrated into quantum mechanics quite nicely, even though it took a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of got integrated. So what is happening is quantum field theory is describing three very fundamental forces of nature.
Mm-hmm.
One is the electromagnetic force. The second is the weak nuclear force. And then the third is the strong nuclear force. Now, these are the three, we'll call it just electromagnetic, weak, and strong. And and these three forces were described by three different theories, actually. And later, what happened was they were successfully able to combine the electromagnetic theory with the weak force theory called the electroweak theory.
Mm-hmm.
Now notice that in all this discussion, I have left out gravity completely out of this discussion.
Right, yeah.
So that was discovered, and the theory was well-developed by 1915. And then this Einstein's dream was to combine this, at least the first try was to combine the electromagnetic force with the gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there was a development like that, which happened actually quite near that time, after publication of Einstein's 1915 great work, was by 1919, Theodor Kaluza and Klein developed this theory called, Kaluza, which is known as Kaluza-Klein theory, which was successfully combining electromagnetic force with the gravity. Mm. It's actually a five-dimensional theory, they used to call it. But there were some problems with that theory, and it didn't work out at the end. But it provided a hint that maybe, if you want to combine gravity with all these three other forces, our space-time, we may not be able to handle that thing within this four-dimensional framework. The four-dimensional means three space and one time.
Mm-hmm.
So the dimension must go up. So that is kind of the moral of the 1919 story, actually.
Sure.
Of Kaluza-Klein. Now, as we progress forward in the development of quantum field theory, where they decided to completely leave out gravity out of the picture and try to combine these three forces, the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic. Now, the electroweak theory developed quite well. However, the strong was it has been hard to combine the strong force with these two forces, even though it has a very nice description by quantum field theory called quantum chromodynamics that describes this this strong force. However, combining it at with the electro weak forces, that combination would lead to what is known as the grand unified theory, or it is called the GUT. G-U-T. So the GUT theory, there were few others which basically they were candidate. There are candidate theories for that, and each of them has some interesting features. One of them is actually was proposed by Sheldon Glashow, who said that, well, I mean, but there was a price that came with that, and which said that proton, which is considered a very stable particle, proton will have to decay. Of course, you know, almost every from hydrogen atom to everything else has proton in it. And proton and electron are our kind of like our staple, so to say. And a decaying of the proton is bit worrisome. However, the time scale is extremely large. But they have extremely large means like almost astronomically large time scale when it decays.
Okay.
However, if you do an experiment, actually, they conducted an experiment and in Kamiokande in Japan, and they found that there is a, they didn't observe it yet, decay of proton.
Is that a limitation of technology?
No, it was, they are thinking that, you know, they have a lower limit of the decay time, which is, I think, as I recall, it is around 10 to the power of 31 or 33. I mean, 10 follows by 31 zeros. I mean, that many years it takes. So,
right.
So if you take that many, 10 to the power of 30, 31 number of protons, then in 1 year, you should see one decay of a proton.
Okay.
However, they didn't observe. But that is the lower limit of it, though.
Sure.
Which means it could be, number of years could be way more than that.
You're listening to Dr. Patrasati Nag. He's a professor of mathematics at Black Hills State University. We'll have more with Dr. Nag after the break. Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Nag from Black Hills State University. We're talking about the search for a unified theory that provides a theoretical framework that explains all physical aspects of the universe. So how much are we limited as we seek out these answers to some of these big mysteries still? How much are we limited by the technology we have? And how much are we limited by imagination and our own ability to comprehend things?
I think mostly the first thing is actually what Einstein used to say, imagination. That imagination has flowered over this last 20, 30 years. And that's where the great theory of supersymmetry has come into existence. Now, what happened that supersymmetry had an interesting feature, though, that if you apply the supersymmetric transformation on a particle twice, what happens is that the particle changes from, say, a fermion to a boson, and then you apply the transformation again, and you get that fermion.
Oh.
Interesting thing is, this: when you do this transformation, the particle has scooted a little bit. It moved a little bit in space-time. So now this mobility of a particle that happened to this transformation is very interesting. Then, okay, a particle moved. How does a thing move?
Right.
Well, that is governed by the special theory of relativity. But what is the force? Oh, the force then is gravity. So if you incorporate supersymmetry locally in special theory of relativity, you get a theory which used to be called the supergravity theory. So supergravity was kind of abandoned around the 70s or the 80s, and then came this fantastic structure which was developed. And mostly the structure that I'm going to talk about is about the superstring theory, which was basically a structure where the particle is not considered anymore a point particle, but is like a string. So literally, the vibrations of the string or the tension energy that is there in a string produces the mass and so on of the particle. And the interaction of the particle is string-string interaction and so on.
So when you say vibration and you say string, my daughter's a cellist and I start thinking about strings on a cello, is it anything exactly remotely like that?
Exactly, yeah. It's almost like the world is on a violin.
Was Einstein just so drastically ahead of his time?
Well, Einstein, this we have progressed way farther than Einstein, because string theory is said to be called the we are talking about 20th century physics problem with the 21st century mathematics.
Okay.
So yeah. The mathematical apparatus has developed so significantly that this is you can call the cutting edge of research. Now, there are various types of string theory, though. So that's type 1 theory. They call type 2A, 2B. Then there is heterotic string theory. And there are heterotic, there are two versions of that. Now, Edward Witten of Princeton has suggested that all these string theories, these various versions of string theory, the five different versions I mentioned, and supergravity, they are limits or perturbative, they call it, if you perturb this unknown theory called the M theory. If you perturb this M theory, then these five theories are, or five plus one if you include supergravity in some sense, can be obtained from this theory under development called the M theory.
Okay.
And M is, God knows, it is magic or whatever this great theory is, that is supposed to be the theory of everything. So the end of the story is that there are all these string theories which can be derived from this unknown theory called M theory, whose features are known, but people are still working on it. However, there are other aspects that I haven't discussed, but there are things that are fantastic objects like brains, BRANES, which are essentially like a sheet of, you know, like a sheet or a volume, volume-like objects moving through space, it is considered like if you are in a three brain. All the forces like the electric weak force and the strong force lives on this brain, and gravity, with the help of its quantum particle graviton, can float away from this three brain, and when it floats away, that's why we find gravity weak in compared to other three forces. Gravity seems to be weaker. And it was hard to explain why gravity is so weak.
Right.
So this idea of this brain concept that was developed, again, around the 90s or so, it started with the name. It's called actually D-Brains. Actually, it's named after Dirac, Paul Adrian Maurice Dirac, the great English physicist. But he didn't work with anything with brains or anything of that sort. He was working in the 1930s and 40s. However, there are certain objects. I think certain aspect of that has. That's why some aspect of the brains contain this some Dirac's theory. So it has a tangential link to Dirac. So they call it a Dirac brain, D brain actually.
So if you
and then and that D3 brain means it's the it's that it's a basically a three-dimensional a volume, kind of. You can think of it as a volume moving through space-time, producing. And the things which are outside the brain is called bulk. People might, you know, relate to the movie Interstellar, where they talked about this bulk idea. It is kind of interesting that popular culture has now adopted that, the concept of bulk, and this. So the outside the brain is the bulk, the higher dimensional space, and we are living on a brain, three-dimensional brain. So that is that kind of theory. Which is offshoot of the string theory and so on.
If we can get our minds or get our arms wrapped around the theory of everything, what can we explain?
We will be able to show that all these four forces come out of something, come out of this structure, actually, the theory of everything structure. All these four forces come out of this development they're looking for.
What kind of minds do you need? What kind of thinking do you need from the next generation of mathematicians and physicists to take this kind of thinking to the next level, to the next step?
I think the mathematics of this is so complicated that the newer generation of mathematicians or physicists have to work together. It is actually a fantastic time where math is sometimes leading physics, and then physics is leading mathematics. It is almost like a time where, in almost like a Newton's time, where Isaac Newton was discovering calculus to explain motion of moon around the earth, and he found like the apple falling from the tree almost similar to moon falling on the earth, but essentially it is because of its velocity around, it is kind of like going in circles. So you find that, you know, this theory of gravity which Isaac Newton was able to formulate and able to calculate the motion of planets and other terrestrial objects, celestial objects, rather. Of course, it was used in terrestrial things. Any mechanical object nowadays follow Newton's laws. The discovery of calculus, differential calculus, integral calculus, these tools helped propel, you know, part of that free thinking of the Renaissance. Similarly, the mathematics being developed from this physics and the then the mathematics gives insights into some of these physical phenomena, develops the physics. I mean, it's just in some sense, mathematics and physics are, one should say that, you know, it should be part of the integrated study of if someone wants to be make a contribution to this field. Has to have that flavor of the physics, the applied aspect to know nature using techniques from advanced techniques from mathematics.
Are we in a renaissance of sorts now, do you believe?
I think so. It is actually an amazing time because the level of development in mathematics due to propelled by this discovery of this trying to discover supersymmetry, trying to discover a unified theory of three forces and gravity has propelled massive research in mathematics. There are various areas of mathematics that has opened up where mathematicians are studying, apart from the actual physical application. This is pure mathematical research they're doing. And sometimes mathematical research, what is done, helps, not necessarily right now, but maybe down the road one might find, this particular thing that was discovered in mathematics is very useful in this explaining certain aspects of a physical phenomena. So it's kind of like pure mathematics is also actually sometimes helpful in many, many times in explaining certain physical phenomena which we kind of come across at some other point of time.
Dr. Nag, I think you're awesome. So thank you so much for all of that.
I am just like anybody else trying to understand.